As you know, this is about the three characteristics this evening, and I'm going to talk a little bit about what they are, and then Sue's going to talk about how to bring them into practice, into life. So the three characteristics, they've just been super important in my practice, and I hope I'm able to offer a little bit that will be helpful for you. And they're, in a sense, the three characteristics of reality. They're at the very heart of understanding how mindfulness works and how our practice brings us to awakening. The three characteristics are the characteristic of impermanence, the characteristic of not self, and the characteristic of unsatisfactoriness, or dukkha, sometimes called suffering. They describe how things are, in a sense, how the universe is. And all three reveal themselves naturally just from our practice, from our mindfulness practice. In the extraordinary book, The Manual of Insight by Mahasi Sayadaw, he talks about these three. He says, "It's only when I note these phenomena as they are and realize their three characteristics that I won't worry about them and will be able to note with equanimity. That's what will lead me to the experience of Nibbana, where none of these exist. Only then can I realize liberation." So you can see how significant these are. So you might say that they're a gateway to awakening, a portal for seeing how things are. And for those of you who've studied Mahayana teachings, the three characteristics are kind of like cousins to the Mahayana view of emptiness. So they're close together. And together, these three and emptiness are one of the teachings, perhaps the teaching that's most distinctive about Buddha Dharma, about what the Buddha taught in terms of pointing us towards ultimate freedom from conditioning. Simply put, the three characteristics lead us to not clinging, just that simple not clinging that is so powerful. And a bit of good news about these three is they shed a more positive light on some of the things that seem to us problems in our meditation practice. In particular, there's that, you know, you ever sit down and you think, oh, you're going to have this serene, everything will be serene like a still forest pool, but instead you find your mind moving as fast as a forest of chimpanzees. So this is a way, and I'll explain, to help that be helpful. Because as we'll see, the constant appearing and disappearing of phenomena as we cultivate mindfulness is actually a doorway to recognizing the nature of things. This constant movement that we see, in a sense, is how things are. We're just seeing it. And yes, deep stillness can arise in mindfulness meditation, and that's good and helpful in terms of penetrating insight. But it's okay when it doesn't. And a paradox is, even in the deepest stillness, there's an undercurrent of seeing constant change. So this sense of change or motion, it's called impermanence, called anicca in Pali. It's a core Buddhist understanding about which volumes have been written. And, you know, how do we see this impermanence? Of course, all of us sees the simpler, coarser levels of impermanence. You know, we all age. Rivers wear down their banks. The freshest flower or muffin is quickly past its prime. Everyone knows that. Everybody knows that. But in a subtler way, in terms of what goes on inside of us, you know, we try to settle our mindfulness on the breath and all these legions of thoughts come up, or emotions, all these things, these long stories, all this stuff comes and goes. And as we cultivate mindfulness of it and don't get lost in it, we see that as quickly as things appear, they disappear and they leave no more trace than a movement of fish through water. Just this constant flux of appearing and disappearing and appearing and disappearing. And it may seem, you know, like a problem, but actually it isn't. We're seeing how things are. We're having a glimpse of this impermanence, this constant change. And we didn't notice it before we sat down to practice, because we were kind of oblivious. We were in the middle of it. We sat down to practice. We sit and cultivate attention. And then it becomes like glaringly obvious. And we also haven't seen this movement because part of how we navigate the world as we try to codify and solidify phenomena around us, we seek satisfaction in a kind of a concocted stability. But what we'll see from what we're talking about now is a better and more successful approach is to find equanimity in the middle of change rather than trying to stop it from changing. And as we practice, we find this understanding of impermanence becomes more and more subtle. So the arising and passing of phenomena, in a sense, it happens so fast, it almost seems like things are sparkling. And at that point, you just go with it because you ain't going to stop it. You ain't going to stop it. And we see that things that we thought were like solid structures that are made of transient parts all in relationship with each other, but there's this constant flow happening. There's a term used in Buddhism, dependent arising, which means everything arises in dependence upon something else. Any thought that arises, any feeling that arises, it's got an origin somewhere, a cause somewhere, an interconnection with something else. And because of that constant interplay, a myriad factors, nothing ever stands still. You know, I mean, we may think that there's parts of our life are static, but actually they're ever changing. It's kind of like someone looks out over Puget Sound, you know, and they think, oh, it's this big still lake. But anyone who's lived here for very long knows that that's not true at all. It's like a constant movement of currents going all different directions and tumbling around. It's this totally dynamic thing. So our experience is just like that. And this matters because the more we can see this impermanence, the more our relationship with those things changes. But it does suggest the need to keep cultivating mindfulness. Joseph Goldstein says, I find it a very powerful practice to pay attention moment by moment to the experience of things changing. Rather than just getting lost in the content of what is happening, it is simultaneously possible to pay attention to the fact that experience keeps altering and flowing. This is not such a difficult thing to do, but it is difficult to remember to do it. That's the trick, right? To remember to do it. And if we don't, if we're kind of oblivious about appearance, about impermanence, then we try to construct our lives around a mistaken notion of safe dependability. We'll try to blind ourselves to the changing nature of things and try to get things to stop changing in a way that favors us. You know, if we find something that's pleasant, we'll try to get it to stop. That's why, I don't know, that's why people go to Hawaii going to Hawaii is good. But if we try to have every bit of life be a Hawaii sunset, you can't stop sunsets, you know? There's a beautiful sunset, then it gets dark. And if things are unpleasant, we'll be more likely to view that as a circumstance we want to change in order to bring a happy life. But sometimes you can't. But then phenomena change by themselves. So just can get less sticky about it and just roll with it. And it's just brings a much happier being. So as we increasingly realize impermanence, we become more comfortable with this reality of incessant change. And we're more apt to accept reality, phenomena, as they happen. And we gain the wisdom and equanimity to know what we can change and what we can't, and to be at peace with both. And this doesn't mean, you know, inaction or passivity. It just means wisdom in the middle of what's happening. And that means we can respond flexibly and creatively and change when we can, but roll with what we can. And as we see this interconnected flux, it just life gets less sticky. If things are always moving and changing, what's there to cling to? Who are we going to cling? You can't find it. You can't grab it. And we see that our emotions, our thoughts, our sensory experience, all this flux is just happening. We're not stuck so much. We're not stuck. So great peace and freedom come out of realizing impermanence, a sense of well-being just from being in tune with how things are. And that's the first characteristic. Now, the second one has to do with how understanding this flow relates to our sense of self. Because as we look at this ever-changing interdependence of everything, and especially in all our mental phenomena, which is mostly where we exist, we begin to understand that constant change applies to us. And in particular, it applies to our sense of self-identity, or in particular, it applies to all the aspects of what's flowing by that we think makes up our sense of self-identity. You know, our natural default as human beings is we think of ourselves as this specific entity, a self-identity, myself. We think there's an I in there somewhere, the essence of who we are and who we'll always be. And conventionally speaking, yep, this is true. I'm Steve, Steve my whole life, and I'll die as Steve, conventionally. But we look more deeply in our mindfulness, in an ultimate sense, with our mindfulness practice, and then this gets much more elusive. You know, people are always telling, when two people meet, they have this conversation where they tell each other the stories of themselves so they can kind of locate with each other. Well, we sort of do that to ourselves. You ever notice when you're meditating and you tell like all these stories to yourself, we're constantly telling stories to ourselves about ourselves and reframing who we are and what we're going to do and what we did. So we're constantly like having this dialogue with ourselves about ourselves, making up ourselves, trying to convince ourselves that we are someone we like. But as we look deeper with mindfulness and become aware of all this phenomena going on, our sense of there being an inherent self anywhere starts to break apart. Because where is it? We see more clearly in the arising and passing of all these thoughts and memories and feelings and emotions and sensations that there's no core self anywhere. There's just all these things going by. You know, look for it. Is it in our body somewhere? Is it in our mind somewhere? Where is self? In our thoughts? You start to realize, oh, that's the impermanent thing. They're all constantly moving and changing. And it's that can be a little spooky, a little unnerving, like your toes are off the edge of a cliff when you see that sometimes. But it is, in fact, how it is. The Buddha concluded that we could not find a self anywhere so powerfully that he offered this to the five ascetics. And as you may know the story of the Buddha, he had five buddies, basically, that he was with for a while. And then he went off and kind of found the middle way and started, like, eating, and they thought he was becoming a slob and ignored him. But then when he saw where they were with his mind's eye and went to Sarnath, where they were, and gave them one teaching about the Four Noble Truths, and then the second teaching was even more radical, because that's when he talked about not self. And he has it's a long one, but he goes through all the different aspects of self, but he says, for instance, he says, You should truly see any kind of consciousness at all, past, present, or future, internal or external, coarse or fine, inferior or superior, far or near, all consciousness with right understanding. This is not mine. I am not this. This is not myself. So just kind of kick the supports out from under them, any place that they thought they were stuck. And as it says, all five awakened right there. Poof. So maybe that just happened. I don't know. But all five awakened right there. So this is a truth that kind of sneaks up on us on cat feet. You know, it deepens with practice. You keep looking and seeing what you see in your practice. And every time we're aware, you know, every time you're telling a story of yourself, be mindful there and you'll start to say, oh, you again. But it's just you again. It's not yourself you're finding. And this changes everything, because we realize more deeply there's nothing to get attached to and there's nobody to attach to anything. It sort of cuts attachment from both sides. Everything's impermanent, nothing to be attached to, nobody here to attach, nobody to cling. Kind of unpacks that whole thing. And this is showing us in terms of our sense of self, that this sense of self we hold so dearly, we defend with ferocity in a dispute with the person we love, is actually as ever-changing as sunlight on a pond. There's actually nothing there to defend. We're not the same person today we were yesterday or last month or a minute ago or a second ago. Everything's in flux. None of it's permanent. So, you know, don't accept this because I'm saying it. Just try it out. Just like the Buddha always said, try it out and see what you see, but bring that into your mindfulness practice. And just the stuff that seems like it's moving, that's where you're seeing it. So don't worry about it if stuff is moving by. I'm watching the clock here. So, you know, just and think what this means in your daily life, your human life. That's what I think Susan's going to talk about. But the freedom it brings you makes things less sticky. It makes all the aspects of your personality in constant flux. And there's really, you sort of can't get your shorts in a bunch in the same way, because what's the problem? And that also applies to people in your life, because the qualities that they have, which you might find attractive or repellent, they're not permanent. They're not inherent. They're not inherently theirs either. So this cuts both ways. And you can't really, you know, decide someone is a bad person if you can't even find where it is that they are that. So watch all these things mindfully, and you'll see the freedom this mindfulness brings you about yourself and about others. And it just comes from looking. And then the third characteristic, which will be brief, but is that our primal unsatisfactoriness in life, called dukkha in Pali, or suffering, comes not because of outer circumstance, but because how we see circumstance. That's the problem. It's not about phenomena. It's about what we do with phenomena. Because it's unsatisfactory from a Buddhist point of view when we grasp on the things we like and push away things we don't like, thinking that they're permanent and we can get them to be how we want them to be. It just doesn't work because there's never enough and things slip away. It's also unsatisfactory to root our sense of well-being in some permanent sense of self, some aspect of us that we think is great, and just get stuck there, because that ain't going to stay either. It's a losing battle. It's sand flowing away. So we can't depend on it. But there is a way forward. There is a way forward. And that's, we find freedom as we bring mindfulness to all of this. Bring mindfulness to it, and we're freed as we see the impermanence of things, the lack of sense of self, and we stop clinging. That's how we stop suffering. That's how we stop suffering. That's where dukkha goes away. So this isn't, you know, dukkha's not like a gloomy Buddhist statement about how things are. Actually, it's a statement about how things don't have to be. And it's a catalyst for moving away from that, for choosing the doorway of mindfulness and letting go into not clinging, so we won't suffer. So these three, impermanence, not self, and unsatisfactoriness, are kind of at the core of how mindfulness works, what it shows. And as we go deeper into this practice, this is what gets clearer to us incrementally over time. And, you know, there's never a moment of mindfulness wasted, because you're always untangling the very tangles that keep us stuck. I'm going to finish with a quote from Joseph Goldstein. He says, "Through our practice of mindfulness and wisdom, we keep deconstructing the sense of self until only ultimate ease remains. Although there are many different descriptions of the enlightened mind, there is one reference point of understanding that illuminates them all, the final uprooting of greed, hatred, and ignorance. The third noble truth is the cessation of dukkha. Realized is the unconditioned. Achieved is the end of craving."